I'm Nora Kathleen Berryhill, and you are listening to Conversations on the Edge, an On the Edge News podcast where we discuss the issues, culture, and politics shaping the Edgewood College community and the world. Today, we are speaking with Professor Amit Pal, who teaches political science at Edgewood College and is also a longtime editor and contributing writer for the Madison-based magazine, The Progressive. He is currently working on a book about the rise of right-wing populism around the world, which is what he's here to discuss today. Amit, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Nora, for having me.
So to begin with, the term populism has been thrown about quite a bit over the past 5 or so years in the news, but populism itself can define quite a wide range of political movements, many of which have very different ideologies. How would you define more generally what populism is? And then can you explain some of the specific characteristics of modern right-wing populism?
Yes, Nora. The term populism is a paradox because it's used so much now, not just in the United States, but globally, and yet so little understood. And part of the problem is that it's what they call in political science a thin ideology. In other words, unlike, say, communism or fascism, for example, it's not a fully thought out worldview. And so it's kind of, you know, something that almost political leaders employ on the fly to sort of, you know, to get political traction and get elected. And we can see that, for example, in the presidential campaign of President Trump. So populism, essentially, without first going into the right-wing and the left-wing variants, is about having this notion of having possessing an unmediated bond with the people and not having that bond be broken by institutions or the elite or the establishment, reflecting the will of the people in almost a mystical way. And that's what populism comes down to, whether it's President Trump or Bernie Sanders on the left domestically, or Modi, Boris Johnson, etc., in places like England and India. And in terms of the right-wing variant, this is how right-wing and left-wing populism differ. Right-wing populism punches both upward and outward. So in other words, they take on the elite, most often defined as the cultural elite. So for example, in India, I laugh. There's this long-forgotten architect of New Delhi whose name has become a byword in India. He was Edwin Lutyens. And so the shorthand for the elite in India that Modi overthrew is the Lutyens elite. And so, you know, just defining that secular kind of center-left elite that Modi has supposedly overthrown. So they punch upward at the cultural elite and then outward at minority or immigrant groups. Left-wing populism, on the other hand, punches just, so to speak, in a manner of speaking, just upward generally at the establishment economic elite. And their focus is on changing the economic order.
So then kind of to go off of some of those ideas, from a macro perspective, do you think that this rise in specifically right-wing populist movements is largely a backlash against modernization and globalization, as many political scientists have suggested? Or do you think that there's many other factors at play as well?
Two main factors are indeed these. Globalism, if you want to distinguish it from globalization, which I think of it as a more economic term. So globalism, which encompasses both trade and economic globalization, and opening up your borders, being more welcoming of immigrants. So definitely it's a backlash against globalism. And then also, as you said, against modernization and the secular idea in places ranging from Turkey under Erdogan, who's been there in power, again, a right-wing populist for many, many years, to India under Modi. But also, it is a revolt against the establishment and the what is seen to be the corrupt, discredited establishment. And again, in places as wide-ranging as the United States, to Brazil, to India, it has been a revolt against the status quo, exemplified by outsiders. Let us remember, President Trump was very much a political outsider. We don't think of him that way. To Bolsonaro in Brazil, to Modi in India, who are more established political figures, but certainly not part of the inside elite. So yes, it is a revolt against modernization / secularism and globalism, but also a revolt against the establishment.
And is this wide kind of broad idea of anti-institutionalism, anti-establishment, is that why populism is such a broad term and can define so many different political movements?
Absolutely. And across the spectrum, as I said, you know, in the United States, we have two very well-known political figures at the either end of the ideological divide. And that's Senator Bernie Sanders on one end, on the left end, and Trump on the right end. In Europe, it's mostly defined by right-wing parties, but again, Syriza, which was a left-wing formation in Greece and was actually in power there, is an example of a left-wing populist formation. And even in Spain right now, Podemos, which is the junior partner in the coalition government, is another example of a left-wing populist formation.
So in much of your recent writing for The Progressive, you compare and contrast the rise of right-wing populism specifically in the U.S. under President Donald Trump and in India under Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And then in a 2018 article entitled From India with Fear, you talk about the commonalities between Modi and Trump. You go on to write that Trump has imitated much of Modi's political style, even creating a campaign ad modeled after Modi's. Can you elaborate on these similarities and why you think Trump has emulated Modi's politics?
Well, Nora, let me preface this by saying that it's uncertain how much President Trump learns and picks up from the rest of the world. So we have to sort of keep that in mind. But there's a specific fascinating instance, and the reason was that President Trump wanted to appeal to the Indian American segment of the population. So Modi, in 2014, listeners, you have to check this ad out, because it is unique in the annals of campaigns. For the first time, I think a presidential candidate spoke, so in quotation marks maybe, extensively in a foreign language, and none other than Donald Trump, who may make you even more surprised. So in 2014, Modi in India had a slogan, Apki Bar Modi Sarkar, which means this time a Modi government. An Indian-American right-wing benefactor and donor gave Trump money for this ad. And I'm not making this up. He actually spoke in Hindi the sentence, Apki Bar Trump Sarkar. You all have to check out this ad in an attempt, as I said, to appeal to the Indian American segment of the population. Jimmy Kimmel had actually had fun playing it for Indian Americans and asking them what Trump was saying, even though it was a language that they understood, Hindi, but many of them were unable to decipher what exactly he was saying. I've heard it took him multiple takes to get it right. So he actually did much more practice for this than you usually attribute to him.
Do you think that Trump has, he's made these attempts, you're saying, to kind of target the Indian American vote. Do you think he's been effective in doing so?
Not quite, Nora. So that ad basically didn't work all that well. He gets about 1/5. The current polls, even for, there was a big article in the New York Times for the upcoming election, show him getting about the same number. So 1/5 or so of the Indian American vote. So given that he has had, even when he was running, an anti-immigrant kind of rhetoric on the campaign trail, and now an anti-immigrant, if I may be honest, track record, his appeal to Indian Americans is limited in spite of, and this is so fascinating, Nora, his quasi-friendship is the best way to put it with Modi. They've had disputes over trade and stuff, but it's no coincidence that the last trip Trump made before the pandemic was to India, where he was received with open arms in a cricket stadium in Modi's home state of Gujarat and in New Delhi. Modi, when he came here last September, Indian-American right-wingers actually organized a huge rally in Texas, and Modi and Trump were both there. So there has been that traction that Trump has attempted to get off his alliance with India, but because, as I said, of his not welcoming attitude toward immigrants, his appeal has been limited.
And then speaking more broadly, this is a very broad question. What kind of message do you think it sends internationally that the leaders of the two largest democracies in the world, India and the U.S., are both led by right-wing populists?
Yes, Nora, if I may be frank, I mean, that sends a bit of a troubling message. Both these countries, and I'm so proud of the fact, Nora, that both the countries I come from have been founded as secular entities and as diverse entities, pride themselves on it, diverse in different ways, of course. India is religiously diverse. United States is religiously diverse also, but also, you know, ethnically diverse. India is also. So there are parallels. And this diversity and the social fabric has come under strain in recent years. And so that is indeed troubling. And that both of these countries combined have a population, as I point out to people, of 1.5 billion plus. So, and they send very strong messages to the rest of the world, United States globally, and India certainly to the global South, at least.
For my next question, Trump has already filled two Supreme Court justice seats and will most likely fill a third, Amy Coney Barrett, in the coming weeks, unless something drastically changes. This has become Trump's primary reelection pitch to conservative voters who may not like Trump's politics, but want to secure a conservative majority in the Supreme Court. Both Trump and Modi have been criticized for attempting to bypass the legislature and undermine rule of law through their respective Supreme Courts. Why do many populist leaders use the courts to extend their executive power? And what are the long-term implications of this?
So first, Nora, we have to take into account the contrast between the U.S. Supreme Court and the Indian Supreme Court. And a striking contrast, of course, is, and I don't know of any other country in the world where there are lifetime appointments. So the electoral issue of Supreme Court and appeals court justices and judges is unique to the United States. That's why. In India, et cetera, they're fixed, limited terms. And so even if somebody has his or her way in terms of appointments, it doesn't last that long. So that's an important contrast, but yet, yes, both have used appointments, judicial appointments in a way, in spite of their disdain for establishment institutions as a way of furthering their agenda. Trump has now, 200-ish appointments, federal appointments, federal judicial appointments, which have served him well. And in India, Modi, the Supreme Court has been just so compliant and so craven, if I may say so, in terms of not addressing issues ranging from Kashmir, which was its autonomy was revoked, this province in the north, to protests against the very dubious, and we'll talk about this, Nora, perhaps, Citizenship Amendment Act, to a lot of other things. So really, they've used the court to their benefit, the Supreme Court especially, in both these countries.
Yes, and I'm not sure for Modi, but Trump has been very vocal in, you know, touting his Supreme Court nominees and central in many ways to his presidency as well.
Yes, Nora, but in India, as I said, judicial appointments are not as much of an electoral issue because they aren't that long term. So the impact is immediate and stark, but not necessarily in terms of duration. Length is much shorter than here, which is why, you know, people don't campaign on that as much.
Sure. Yeah. And that is a very important distinction, I think, to make. So going off of that point, in India, the next prime minister, would they be able to reverse these decisions? Do you know how long is the typical?
Yeah, good question, Nora. It's changed. And in fact, they've tried to shield somewhat the appointments from direct political interference by having this thing called the collegium, which was meant to be this quasi-independent institution. So I should know, Nora, the exact term, but yes. So when the next prime minister comes in, whenever that is, they will have much more realistic chance of changing the composition of the Supreme Court than would Trump's successor, or successors for the next two or three presidents, perhaps.
So more generally speaking, both Trump and Modi have challenged democratic norms in both their respective countries, to some extent revealing the fragility of these norms when challenged. How can the US, India, and democracies around the world become more resistant to populist messaging seeking to underwrite these basic and essential rules of government?
I think, Nora, by making people feel part of the system, that so much of this hankering for a political messiah comes from a complete disillusionment with the way politics currently function in these countries. There's a great article in Harper's on Kenosha, our Kenosha next door. Interestingly, before the racial unrest, so this person went and tried to figure out why so many working class folks vote for Trump. And the conclusion was because they don't feel they are part of the system, that they have no stake in the current system. And so they want somebody, no matter somewhat, let's say, unconventional, to blow the system up. And the same dynamic worked for Modi in India, that they thought the system was so corrupt and so decrepit that somebody, maybe a bit of a strong man, but needs to come and just completely restructure things. So we need to have an inclusive political and socioeconomic system that people don't feel left out and by themselves and not being able to influence decision-making. Our congressman, Representative Mark Pocan, had a great quote in that. He said, for every member of Congress, there are three lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry itself. He said, I don't know who my three are, but that's pretty messed up. And here I'm using an euphemism for what he actually said. But yeah, so we need to change that where, you know, the people at the top basically influence how policies are made and how bills are passed in this country. And the average person has much more of a say in how things are run.
So you're speaking about this idea that motivated so many Trump voters and Modi supporters in India as well, of feeling left out of the system, feeling that the system hasn't benefited them in any way. Do you think that either of these leaders have at all been effective in addressing these concerns? Do you think that they have, in shattering these norms, have somehow led to progress, or have they not served the people that voted for them?
Well, in my opinion, Nora, right-wing populism is a bit of a feint and jab that they sort of, you know, they pretend to basically to solve your economic troubles. And at the same time, it's faux populism in some sense. So at the end, the economic structures are left quite intact. Trump, the one bit of economic populism that he's tried is the whole tariff thing. And even the benefits and the effects of that are debatable, at least. Modi in India is, interestingly, more of a statist than Trump is here. So he has tried to alleviate some of the economic pain. And I've given him credit for that. And these are important things, Nora, as I think you and I very many fair-minded folks would agree. For example, by building toilets, very important in India, because sanitation has to be addressed. Giving women subsidized cooking gas. So those sort of programs. So there has been some, you know, anecdotally and otherwise, my mother says, for example, I don't give enough credit to Modi for all this. there has been some leavening of economic suffering. At the same time, his handling on the macroeconomic front, even before COVID, was just so terrible that unemployment was skyrocketing, GDP was crashing, and now with this thing, it's just gone. I mean, the numbers are just off the charts in a terrible way. So as I said, you know, Trump and Modi both have this notion of solving the economic problems, but they are so fixated with taking on the previous cultural elite that really the attention is elsewhere. And so they aren't very much into basically remedying the economic grievances of even their base.
And do you think that there is a way, a pathway where these economic concerns can be addressed without challenging democratic norms to the point where it threatens the effectiveness of any democratic institutions? Is there a way to kind of reconcile this? Or do you think that the politics has overshadowed any sort of economic positive?
Nora, one important thing I want to stress, which I've overlooked so far in our conversation, is that the rise of right-wing populism especially has been due to the collapse, so to speak, of social democratic parties in these countries. So at the very least, a rightward shift. So let's take the United States, for example. Legacy of FDR was the whole New Deal idea of, you know, sort of social democracy, not as extensive as in Europe, etc., continental Europe especially, but still, you know, like, you know, social security and, you know, and in his time he had a jobs programs program and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So some sort of a social safety net, not as extensive as in continental Europe, for the less well-off. From the time of, especially of the Clintons, if I may name names, the party was shifted rightward, and the whole focus became on, for example, on passing free trade deals like NAFTA, etc., and B, on appealing to the professional elites in our society rather than the working class. And the result was that on certain issues like trade, Trump was able to run to the left of Hillary Clinton, and that damaged her. So you see what I'm saying? So if there are strong social democratic formations in these countries, they can perhaps address from within the establishment the concerns of the less well-off. Similarly, in India, the party is called the Congress Party, has been around since Gandhi's time, even much before that, but carried on the legacy of Gandhi and Nehru, India's first prime minister, was quite strongly left-leaning. Came more and more to the center and the right as time went on. And I think what's happened with the rise of Modi can be partly explained by that in India. So as I said, strong social democratic formations can alleviate and can address the economic grievances of the less well-off without necessarily having to overturn establishment norms.
And I guess even just to look at the interesting phenomenon of a lot of Bernie Sanders voters that voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries in 2016 did not like Hillary Clinton's politics and then voted, turned to vote for Trump in the general election. You know, that was talked about, and, you know, I think that the overlap and the kind of current that runs between these two politicians that are ideologically very different is kind of what you're saying with this focus on the economy, this focus on addressing economic grievances and concerns. Though both politicians had very different means of addressing, both had that as a focus in their campaigns.
Very much so, Nora. The similarities and differences between Bernie Sanders and Trump is of such fascinating personal and scholarly interest to me, and how they overlap in certain ways. For example, most famously on trade, but even in terms of in foreign policy, even in terms of international military alliances, For example, both are not exactly fans of NATO and of U.S. deployment in countries all over the world. What Trump is doing in terms of bringing back troops from Afghanistan, etc., I think Bernie maybe would have done sort of the same thing. So there are, isn't that fascinating that they're so different in so many ways, and yet there are some similarities also.
And then to move on and kind of shift, we've been talking a lot about some of the similarities between Modi and Trump in terms of politics, but I want to touch on some of the key differences here. You wrote in that 2018 article that while the U.S. media has, you know, largely taken an oppositional stance to Trump, you said, the opposite has been true in India, with broadcast media casting an especially flattering image of Modi's regime. How do you think this media coverage has influenced voters in India?
Oh, tremendously, Nora. From what I've seen and read, if you're constantly bombarded by pro-Modi news and a slant prevalent pretty much all the time, with the exception of one broadcast channel, and in the print media, I emphasize, there are some print publications and web portals which are critical of Modi. But let's get real. People get news in India, as in the United States, primarily from television. And in terms of social media, etc., it's really fascinating, Nora, that just like there's a Trump base on Facebook, India has this globally. There is a Facebook-owned social media app called WhatsApp, and that is such a barrage of pro-Modi propaganda circulating on that, and that's helped Modi a lot also. So, that's a key difference, that the mainstream media in India, especially broadcast, is very, very right-wing, and it's becoming worse and worse, it seems. You know, in the 2 years since I wrote that piece, it's become even more and more so. That's not necessarily the case in the United States.
I guess an exception to that, though, especially since you're focusing on broadcast media, would be local broadcast media in the U.S., like Sinclair Broadcast, bought up a lot of local organizations. So, you know, even though on, you know, wide national scale, definitely true, but that is interesting with local media has targeted more voters that has been, you know, expressed more pro-Trump positions.
Very much so. Sinclair is there, and then right-wing talk radio. And then, of course, how can we ever forget Fox? So, exactly. So there are, even in the United States, there is a division in that sense, you know, basically. But more of an even division, definitely, than in India.
So kind of going off of that point, do you think that to some extent, I mean, people have been talking about how media has become polarized with people, you know, finding, you know, going more towards either liberal-leaning, conservative-leaning news sources for information, and how that has had, you know, an increasingly polarizing effect on the American population. You know, on the other hand, in India, with more, do you think that there's been a similar effect with that, you know, because they're, it, as you said, it's more a little bit more even-handed. Do you think that polarization in media has polarized America further? And then how do you think that that contrasts with more media that is favorable towards Modi overall in India?
Good question, Nora. Definitely there's been, obviously, a polarization of worldviews in the United States. Really, I mean, I think right-wing folks trust little else except Fox and watch that. And that really informs the way they look at the world in a very, very different way. You know, I go to the gym and exercise there, and I see what Fox is covering. They have both Fox and CNN, and how different the coverages are. Of course, on Fox, for example, the major news story recently was the Hunter Biden story that the New York Post broke about alleged malfeasance by the Biden family. On CNN, it was, you know, Trump and his sort of, you know, supposed misdeeds. So definitely in India, it's interesting. Yes, I mean, so there's even a sharper divide. And any independent media entities left, there's a trolling of them in a really, Nora, in a really vicious, misogynist way, especially when there are women reporters. You won't believe it. I mean, you know, the mildest epithets are stuff like, it's not the secular media, but the sickler media. And, you know, they think it's kind of very smart wordplay. So secular, sickler, get it, folks? So that sort of thing, and it becomes even worse and worse from there. As I said, very quickly taking on misogynist undertones and overtones, especially when there are women editorialists or reporters involved.
So then with all of this, do you think in India it's even more important that there's access to international media coverage? You know, the BBC, for example, that covers international politics, to get more of an equal balance of perspectives?
Oh, very much so, Nora. But although, you know, a lot of that right-wing kind of his fan base are like, oh, well, you know, because they're so nationalist. So they're like, you know, the Western media is out to get us. And the Western media is anti-Modi because he stands up for Hindus, you know, and so, you know, and they can't stand his rise. So there's that sort of perspective, but definitely. Let me take you back to my early childhood. I was 6 or 7 years old when there was a dark period in India, when a state of emergency was imposed and the media was censored. And even then, Nora, guess what was salvation for the Indian people in terms of access to free media? BBC on shortwave radio, English, Hindi, or whichever language you spoke. And people found out what was ironically what was happening, actually happening in India from a foreign broadcaster. So definitely, you know, and now there's the net, of course, you know. So, and to its credit, as far as I know, the Indian government has not tried to limit access to the net, at least so far. By the way, they just kicked out Amnesty from India. They made it so difficult for Amnesty International to operate in India, going after them, checking, double checking, auditing their accounts and stuff, that Amnesty said, we have to leave. So India is in the august company of Russia, which is the other major country which Amnesty had to abandon recently.
And then when you wrote this article that I keep referencing here, in 2018, you also spoke to you also spoke as a difference to how there was less vocal opposition to Modi in India compared to Trump in the U.S. Of course, since then, things are somewhat different. As you referenced before, in 2019, there were widespread protests throughout India against the Citizenship Act amendment. What about this do you think has pushed more Indians to show up and protest Modi's regime?
So it was going to be a double whammy put on hold right now because of the pandemic. The Citizenship Amendment Act coupled with the National Registry of Citizens. So in other words, if you didn't have proper ID and documentation on you, you can be cut off, especially, and this is where it's important, the biggest oppositional bloc to Modi's government are the Muslims. And so they could be cut off. This is voter suppression on a scale that, Nora, that we can't imagine in the United States, and done nationally. You could be cut off the voter registration rolls. If other people then don't have IDs, etc., proper documentation, the Citizenship Amendment Act enables them to get citizenship by claiming to be refugees from neighboring countries, which enables all major non-Muslim communities to get, it grants them a pathway to citizenship. So you see what's happening, Nora, the 14-15% of India that's Muslims. If you can get those numbers down, even by a couple of million, their votes, that can make all the difference in a number of constituencies. It's such a blatant attack on the notion of Indian secular nationhood and citizenship that people came out to protest starting late last year in a number of cities all around the country. Muslims, but Hindus and other communities too. This is going on, again, another casualty of the pandemic, so to speak. The protests, which were large scale and continuing, had to be dissolved because of the pandemic. So in March, basically, there was a hold. On the flip side, as I said, there's been a hold on that entire plan to take a nationwide kind of, you know, registry of all citizens and to ask them to prove their citizenship, because obviously in a pandemic, that's very, very difficult to do.
Do you think that going forward in the future, if there is more vocal opposition, as there has been, to this, that it would have a, you know, substantial impact on this being able to be enacted?
Yes. I mean, a number of states that have been opposition ruled, that are opposition ruled, have anyway said we're not going to cooperate with these enumerators coming around and asking people for documentation, etc. So yes, absolutely. I think, you know, once, you know, obviously we're in the middle of a really weird, unique situation, but when and if they decide to resume this notion of asking everybody for the documents, etc. The act, by the way, was passed, that Citizenship Amendment Act, but the enumeration of people, asking them to prove their citizenship, definitely there'll be large-scale protests again. People won't stand for that. At least a portion of the population won't stand for that.
Do you think that there could also, you know, be a lesson learned here with voter ID laws in the states?
So here, Nora, of course, you know, the it being, and we've discussed this in the class that I'm teaching you also, the Indian constitution, it said, is federal in letter, but unitary in spirit. And the United States, and I think it's a good thing, is federal in both letter and in spirit generally. So here, those laws are made much more at the state and the local levels. So it's not a uniform national kind of thing, you know, the voter laws, but absolutely. So, you know, there's been that notion of making it as erecting extra hurdles to basically getting registered to vote, and hoping that that will make a difference in narrow races at the state and the local levels, or even at the national level, of course. Nora, many of our students at Edgewood are that young to remember, but people like me do, that in 2000, that election was decided by a few hundred votes in just the presidential election between Bush and Gore, a few hundred votes in just one state.
Going back to this, the Citizenship Amendment Act, it kind of speaks to this broader notion of a heightening of ethnic and religious divisions that has not only polarized Indian society under Modi, but also American society under Trump. Why do you think right-wing populist leaders target fears and resentments these groups have against each other?
The short answer is that it is a path for them to electoral success, you know, by playing on fears of minorities getting ahead in one sense or the other. They're able to mobilize the majority community. And if you're able to mobilize enough of the majority community in terms of numbers, you have it made. And that's the electoral game that President Trump has played in the United States. And got, last time, let's remember, a majority of the majority community. Let me put it that way. And that enabled him to win just narrowly. In India also, the same thing. It's a multi-party system. And he's gotten a majority of the majority community in India too, which enabled him, again, to win about 40% or so of the overall vote. But in a multi-party system, that's enough to win a comfortable majority in parliament.
What do you think, so kind of going off of this, do you think that this will have long-term implications, this kind of political style of right-wing populism in the U.S. and India? Do you think this will have long-term implications for society? You know, we've seen polarization that may have already existed, but was exacerbated under Trump and similarly under Modi. What concerns should Americans have for these divisions not necessarily going away after Trump leaves office, and similarly in India?
Yes, Nora, isn't that the million-dollar question? I mean, can the tap be turned off immediately? I don't know. It seems to me it'll take some time for the fraying of the social fabric to be repaired. I grew up partly in this country as a kid, then came back 3 decades ago now, and I have not seen passions so inflamed and so polarized as they have been currently. Similarly, in India, I don't recognize Indian society right now. It really seems to me that how is this possible that people have so much bile and venom, which was not the case when I was growing up there. So, you know, can this be switched off instantly once these leaders leave? One would hope so, but maybe it's wishful thinking. I think it'll take some time for the fabric to be repaired. But yes, in the absence of a political leader who stokes and plays on these fears, definitely there'll be at least a somewhat cooling down of the temperature.
So going off of this idea of what is the future of right-wing populism, you know, over the past 5 years, we've seen, well, both right-wing and left-wing populist leaders and movements gain power in democratic countries. And so what do you make looking forward, although, of course, the future is unpredictable? Do you think that over the past 5 years under these various populist leaders, do you think that that the past 5 years will define the political future of democracies around the world, like in India and the U.S.?
My feeling is, Nora, that there may be rejection of specific leaders perhaps President Trump. But the underlying issues that lead or have led to the rise of populism, unless they are addressed, my fear is that somebody, or my analysis is, I suppose, that somebody who is more adept and more suave at making these arguments may be waiting for us a few years down the road. So a return to the establishment without addressing any of these underlying grievances may just delay the inevitable, in the sense that President Trump is gone, but 8 or 12 years down the road, somebody else comes who has a similar ideology and worldview, but is more finessed and more adept at putting it forward, and not as undisciplined as erratic as President Trump's critics charge him to be.
And then I guess just ending also, you know, if we're right in the middle of a U.S. presidential election that, you know, will inevitably influence the future of right-wing populism and populism in general, whether Trump will be re-elected or not, what do you think is most at stake in this election?
Well, Nora, that for me personally, there are two things that are most at stake, one internationally and one domestically. Internationally, as I said, personally, I'm very, very concerned about climate change and global warming. And the perspective of the two candidates is very different. As we know, President Trump has pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, and Joe Biden is promising to join that again, this global fight. Again, it depends on your notion of how serious climate change is as a threat. The other is the whole issue of immigration and this being a land of immigrants. And President Trump has really broken drastically with the bipartisan consensus that has existed since the passage in 1965 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, I think is the full title, under which, for example, my parents were able to come in because my father was a professional engineer and got a green card, permanent residency, almost within a couple of months of applying in Germany, where he was there before and I was born. President Trump has to try to put multiple restrictions on legal immigration. We're not talking about illegal immigration. And Joe Biden has promised to go back to the way things were, maybe not fully, but at least substantially. And I think that's going to be a major difference. Again, depends on your perspective on whether you think that's a good or a bad thing.
And then just lastly, as this podcast is made by and for Edgewood College students, I want to shift gears and ask you why you think it's important to be aware of international news and politics. What do you think students gain from learning about current events in other countries around the world?
A better understanding of ourselves, Nora. And I can't give a better example than this unfortunate accursed pandemic that we're all living through. Why has the United States not been able to handle it as well as so many other countries? What have their public health systems done well that we can learn from, for example? And this is a matter of not just, and it's not an arcane intellectual issue. It's something that's affecting all of us here. Social safety nets, the fact that the United States has much more of a laissez-faire capitalist approach, is it a better or a worse thing as compared to the way continental Europe has taken care of its workers? In terms of the pandemic, returning to that, in terms of the way South Korea, Singapore, etc., have handled the pandemic. I mean, these are really by knowing how the rest of the world is operating, even we here in the United States, which I know so many folks consider, because of its immense size and power, to be pretty much the center of the world, I think there's so much we can indeed learn from the rest of the world.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today. Love to have you here.
Thank you so much, Nora, for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Great. And that's all for today's episode. To submit suggestions or learn more, please visit our website at otenews.com.